Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to The Longest Night. We are a Game of Thrones and House of the Dragon show on the Podbreed Network. My name is Rob, and I have seen every single episode of Game of Thrones at least half a dozen times, and I've read Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin.
My name is Lizzie. I've also seen every single episode of Game of Thrones, but I haven't read Fire and Blood by George R.R. Martin.
If you want to, you can find us on Twitter. We are at LongestNightGOT. That is at LongestNightGOT. And our title music was written and provided by a friend of the podcast, Edward Thomas. You can find all of his available work in the description. You will have noticed in the introduction that Jay did not do his usual piece. That's because he's not here this week. So, Lizzie, welcome back, first of all.
Hello.
But it does mean, unfortunately, we have lost Jay this week. He's been struck down with something, and he's not well enough to put his thoughts together for us, unfortunately. But he should be back next week for episode 8. He's also gone to the courtesy of texting in his thoughts about the episode, and we'll be reading those out very, very shortly. Before we get going this week, I should probably do more. I should probably put more effort in to promote the fact that, like, I regularly write about House of the Dragon for Metro.co.uk. Like, I never share my links. I do on the Twitter page, but, like, I never talk about them on the show. But it's just because there's an opinion piece I put up this week about House of the Dragon that I was particularly happy with. When it went out, and it's just about how a particular twist at the end of this episode is probably the smartest move played by House of the Dragon up to this point. I will leave a link to it in the show notes. Okay, let's get going on this one. This week, we are going to be discussing Season 1, Episode 7 of House of the Dragon, entitled Driftmark. It was written by Kevin Lau and directed by Miguel Sapochnik, likely for the final time in the Game of Thrones universe because he's leaving House of the Dragon. Well, he's already left because there's nothing else to do on the first season, so he's not coming back for Season 2. It may be the last thing that he and Fabian Wagner do together in the Game of Thrones universe, which...
Wow.
Yeah, after all the episodes they've given us.
End of an era.
Yeah, it really is. Like, wish them luck and
Absolutely.
Thanks for everything that they did. It's a shame that they're probably not going to come back. Driftmark was first broadcast on the 2nd of October 2022 to an audience that was probably larger than last week, but who even bloody cares anymore? Just get the raw data, HBO. Right, we need to do. Get the
Please,
raw data.
We're begging you.
And just put it in an email to, like, a few editors at magazines and just get the figures out there. You know, the cable figures are out there, but they don't sound as impressive without all the streaming data. So, for every week that HBO don't release the full streaming data, I'm going to read out the cable data as some kind of ransom note. Because the cable ratings are nowhere near as impressive as the streaming ratings, but apparently it went up from 1.86 million viewers last week to 1.88 this week. So, hooray, well done, release the figures.
Yay.
Lizzie, how are we on Season 1, Episode 7 of House of the Dragon?
Yeah, I thought for the most part it was a return to form after what I found to be quite a difficult watch last week, whereas the previous episode felt like some heavy lifting on the plot's behalf to present the changing times. This one felt a lot more focused on, you know, various themes like, you know, grief and love and also revenge, maybe, and also like how each family was individually dealing with the death of Laena in the previous episode. And so it felt kind of thematically consistent. It's like A flow to B, flow to C, which I know sounds like the most basic thing, but given last week where it felt a bit piecemeal, I thought this one was a lot more consistent. However, I do have one complaint, and it is more of a technical one, and it's one that's been pointed out by a number of articles this week and a number of people on social media, I'm sure. It's the lighting it's, you know, much like The Long Night, there are entire sequences of this episode which are near impossible to see unless you're watching on a large screen in a dark room. Like, the use of day for night to simulate the appearance of nighttime with that dark bluish tint becomes incredibly distracting after a while. Like, to quote Stuart Heritage of The Guardian, it feels like it was lit by a single tea light for a bet. And yeah, it's just a disappointing black mark on an otherwise very good episode.
As for myself, this is probably my favourite episode thus far in the show. I think this is a real, like, it's a real
simmering pot.
It reminds me a lot of A Knight of the Seven Kingdoms in the way that you stick a bunch of characters in a location together and just kind of watch what happens. There's a lot of this that feels very natural and organic in a way that a fair chunk of last week felt like, as you said, it felt like it was going to great lengths to, like, quickly fill in a lot of gaps. Fill in a lot of gaps that have been created by the time jump, whereas this week we've not moved forward in time really at all. We're just, like, you know, a week later, everybody's assembled onto Driftmark. There are loads of tensions in the air, and they all kind of come to the fore. With regards to the day for night stuff, first time I watched it, admittedly, it was about 6:30 on Monday morning. So it was 6:30, and it was, you know, we're in October now. The sun doesn't really fully come up until about just gone 7:00. So I still had the curtains drawn, and we've just recently bought some new curtains because we've moved into a new house, and they're quite thick and they block out a lot of light. And so I sat and watched the episode. I was like, wow, that was well good. I come online and the first thing I see is, like, oh, Mikhail Sapochnik, they've not lit it properly again. like this. And I was thinking, huh? Like, was it really that much of an issue? So, like, the next time I watched it, I made a pretty deliberate point of, like, leaving the curtains open this time. And it caused a little bit more of a problem, but I don't think the problems in this episode with regards to the lighting are as anywhere near as pronounced as parts of The Long Night, because at least with the darker sequences in this, you've got that one between Rhaenyra and Daemon, and then you've just got the one between Vhagar and Aemon. And so, like, you know, it's not heavy action sequences and quick cuts or anything like that, so it's not like it can drag the episode down or spoil the experience. But I think the lighting of the beach scene wasn't really a problem for me, but the lighting in the sex scene was.
They were both a problem for me. I'd say more so the beach scene, actually, because given how much of the story this week is told through, like, facial expressions and just small movements and, you know, just, like, even just glances, it's kind of, it does the actors a disservice to not be able to see that.
We'll talk about it a little bit more. I just want to read out Jay's thoughts that he's texted in. So, yeah, he said about this episode, definitely a step up from last week. The incredible tension of the post-I-loss scene made me delightfully uncomfortable. It just kept going and going and twisting and turning like something out of a Tarantino film. And in fact, the claiming of Vhagar and the fight afterwards was also great. I'm growing to both like and hate these sets of kids in equal measure. The build for Viserys has really paid off too. He's so pitiable now, melting piece by piece and helpless, but we've been shown it as the result of his naive desire to please everyone and have everyone just get along. So it's all coming together nicely with him barely keeping people from each other's throats. Not entirely sold on Daemon and Rhaenyra getting together so quickly. I think another casualty of the time skip meant it feels a bit overwritten and heavy-handed. Wish it felt more organic. But the Laenor/Carl ending did send me home happy. Great way of weaving it in with the book canon while still having two characters who've never really done anything wrong get a happy exit from the chaos to come. So, yeah, I think we're all kind of general consensus about this at the very least. I think we're all at varying degrees of enjoying it, but I think we're all sat here thinking and nodding and going, better than the last week or maybe even the last couple of weeks, which is always good.
So, yeah.
Okay. Your girls are the very image of their mother. A comfort and an anguish, as I well remember. The gods can be cruel.
Seems they've been especially cruel to you.
Yes. You should return with us to King's Landing. It's time that you came home.
Pentos is my home. And that of my children.
Daemon. I know we've had our differences. But let them pass with the years. There's a place for you in my court. That's something you should need.
I need nothing.
At Driftmark, the Velaryons, the Targaryens, and the Hightowers all gather for the funeral of Laena Velaryon. It is revealed that Otto Hightower has been reinstated as Hand of the King. Tensions simmer, but things remain cordial. Many family members reunite, while other family members, especially the children, are shown to be kind of meeting each other for the first time. As the afternoon turns to evening, Prince Aegon gets drunk, the rumours about the legitimacy of Rhaenyra's children continue to circulate, and King Viserys mistakenly refers to Queen Alicent as Emma before he retires to bed. And during the gathering, Laenor is spotted standing in the sea, and Corlys demands that Carl go to retrieve him. What do we make of this kind of opening scene where they're all out on kind of like a seaside veranda, all looking at each other, and you know, it's very crowded, very, very crowded scene. How did you feel?
Yeah, well, like you say, all looking at each other, like, it's amazing how much of the story they can tell just by glances. It's like, you know, we discussed the dance scene in episode 5, and again, just storytelling through faces and actions rather than speech. Like, you've got Laena's daughters looking distraught, you've got Otto clutching his lapel with the Hand of the King brooch, almost as if to check it's still there. You've got Laena with his 1,000-yard unbroken stare as he seemingly contemplates every single life choice he's made up to this point. And of course, you've got Aegon puffing his cheeks out in boredom like a right little shit.
Yeah. And you've got Daemon giggling at the sermon as well that's spoken over Laena's body going into the sea.
I think I misread this, because isn't it like, because I'm sure I read in articles like it's because of the whole legitimacy of Rhaenyra's children thing, but I thought it was more like maybe like a nervous laughter thing of just, you know, occasionally that does happen with anxiety, like you're at a funeral and you know you shouldn't be laughing and that makes you laugh and then you can't stop. And it's kind of, yeah.
I think it's a bit of both. I think it's okay. The lines in the sermon are so almost like they've been purposely written just to like make Rhaenyra and Laenor and their children all look at each other like, oh God, this is about us, isn't it? And so Daemon's obviously giggling about that. But yeah, also I think there is a shouldn't do this. So my brain's, it's like target fixation. Where you're trying to avoid doing something and then it just happens out of your control.
Yeah.
I know what you mean, and I totally agree about this episode building itself on looks and glances, characters just kind of catching an eye and then not being able to uncatch the eye. And just, yeah. I love the way that this scene is set up where, especially when Rhaenyra kind of walks through the crowd at the beginning and the camera's kind of snaking after while all these bodies are around. And it's just this really good way of communicating the fact that there are a lot of bodies in a very small space. And right from the beginning, that feels like it sets the tone for the episode straight away, where it's like lots of people in a very small space where they can't get away from each other. And it means that lots of things are going to clash eventually, and lots of things might go wrong as a result. It is a proper potboiler of an episode, and I think this early sequence where they're all looking at each other and observing each other's behaviours, and Daemon letting out that little giggle, and then Corlys looking at him like, why did he do that? And then,
yeah.
I forget the name of the character who's delivering the sermon, but he's looking across at Rhaenyra and Luke and Jace while he's saying the words about the Velaryon blood running thick. And, you know, the line being strong and, like, Rhaenyra just kind of, you know, quietly knocking their heads down to sort of, like, don't listen, don't look, it's fine, just remain polite, just stay polite. But The funeral itself is a really lovely opening. I think it's a gorgeous soundtrack. Really gorgeous soundtrack. I think this actually got me more than her actual death scene. And I think it's because we were surrounded by people who actually knew her and actually cared about her. You know, when she died, it was just kind of Vhagar and Daemon who were there. We felt it from Vhagar, but maybe not so much from Daemon, because Daemon cared about her, but I don't think he was ever really devastated by her death.
No, not really.
And we see that by his actions in this episode. But it's all built on these little silent little things. Like you say, Otto kind of just doing the lapel thing, a kind of mixture of checking he's still wearing it and also like a level of pride, like, yeah, back in my station.
Like, yeah, it's like if someone catches your eye, it's like, yep, that's me.
Yeah.
Out of the king, baby.
And I just love that shot of the coffin kind of joining all of the others, the ones that have been kind of taken over by the seaweed and all the other, like the carved faces and all the other ones like that. And it's like this, you get this sense of, in this episode, and I think it's something that kind of, it moves out, I think, to the show as a whole. Like, it expands a little bit. It's just this feeling of, like, we're watching history develop. Like, in Game of Thrones, I didn't get that feeling so much where, like, we were watching history because, you know, it was all adapted from, like, point of view book chapters, and then we got focused on a set of characters, and then it just kind of took itself to the end. Whereas with this, you know, it's adapted from a historical novel. I think it's episodic, borderline episodic storytelling. It's almost a bit case of the week, actually. It has been a little bit so far. I think the fact that we're kind of jumping through time, I do think it has been to the show's detriment, but I think one thing that it does claw back in its favour is this sense that we're seeing, like, these steps of history. We're checking in at the bits, at the points where things happen, as opposed to all the stuff in between that leads up to the thing that happens. And that's interesting. And I think I get that feeling when the coffin hits the sea floor and you realise there's all these people that have come before, and there's all these people that have stood on these cliffs and pushed other people over them. I imagine Corlys was there pushing his father over the cliff however many years ago before all of this even happened.
Yeah, probably.
And yeah, so that was really interesting, I thought. I don't know if you wanted to speak about your emotions about this scene.
Yeah, I thought it was a really nice ceremony, and it kind of speaks to how alike she was as a person, that you could get all of these parties who were at each other's throats by the end of the episode to be in this place and, for the most part, be solemn and kind of just take in that experience and not, you know, make a scene or anything. Like, even though you do get the odd glance, I think they at least know enough that, you know, this is the least you owe Layla, is just this moment. And, like, so, and also just had a thought that, like, I like how this episode is kind of bookended by Layla and Laenor both kind of leaving the world we know by sea.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's a
in
really
very different ways. But, you know.
Fire is a prison, sea is an escape, is the Rhaenyra's line, isn't it? Yeah. And it's a different way of being set free, I suppose. I got to say, I'm going to miss Ty Tennant as Aegon.
Me too.
He's been excellent. It is a shame that he's not going to be around anymore, because they age them up again. I think we're going to jump forward another couple of years next week.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a shame, because he's been wonderful. I think he's... I think he's... They know he's a bit less is more. I think if he's around all the time, it might get a bit aggravating. But instead, you just kind of get him in a scene and being all like, oof, wench! You know, and things like this, and just getting, like, drunker and more and more drunk until the point where Otto has to sort of pick him up and kick him and, like, come on, get your shit together. Jesus Christ.
You know what I was thinking? He's like if Pete Campbell was a Targaryen.
Yeah, early Pete Campbell anyway.
Yeah,
totally.
Very early Pete Campbell, where he's, like, drinking heavily and being a snotty little twat.
Yeah, I totally agree. There are loads of... the moments with the kids in this episode are really crucial to my enjoyment of it. I think.
Yeah, definitely.
The stuff with the kids is great because, like, there's Bela holding Jace's hand, like, just to kind of comfort him a little bit, even though, you know, it's strange because obviously it's her mum that's died, but she's comforting him, and, like, it's just a nice little bonding sesh between the kids, and, like, you get Corliss leaning down and sort of saying, like, you know, you may become Lord of Driftmark one day, and he's like, I don't, and he says, yes, he says the famous line,
the spirit of Jon Snow lives on.
Yes, I don't want it.
I don't want it.
I don't want it. I never have. Just for people who maybe didn't listen to us while we were covering Game of Thrones, but have tuned in for House of the Dragon, I don't have a problem with the I don't want it lines, and the fact that it became such a massive meme, I think, speaks to a lot of the ill faith that people consumed the last season in. But never mind, that's a bone I picked back in the Game of Thrones era of this show. But it's something else that he says afterwards, where he says that and it's something that I think that quite a lot of the royal families in this show kind of know but don't speak aloud, which is just like, you know, if I get to be Lord of Driftmark, it means everybody's dead.
Yeah. And
children are often the clearest and most honest about death, I find. Like, I remember the children, it's like pets as well. Pets seem to be a certain, that they're open and honest and frank about their feelings about a person not being there anymore, in the same way that children are, in the way that adults have just kind of been slowly conditioned to not say, you know, like all the adults in the room at the moment are all the ones behaving like actual children. And maybe that's the main irony of the episode, but it's just, when I was younger, it just reminded me, like, him saying this, when I was younger, my gran passed away. It was 2006 when she died. And my little cousin was 6 years old or 7 years old at that point. And, well, it was a few weeks after she died, and he turned to my auntie, who's his grandmother, and he went, "Grandma, you're the next oldest. Does that mean that you're next? I don't want you to be next." And so, but it was just this, it was this question that was in his mind, because that's how it kind of worked in his head. Like, you just reached an age and then,
it's like a cue. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I've always appreciate refreshing honesty in moments like this. But again, in a way that adults are kind of like conditioned to go, oh, you shouldn't ask that kind of question. It just kind of came out very honestly. And it's like, it's just like this scene, I think. So yeah, I totally appreciate that. The meeting between Daemon and Viserys, I don't know if you got a couple of words about that.
I've got "be careful what you wish for" there, Viserys asking Daemon to return to King's Landing. But it's also like, he's like a jilted lover, and he just can't stop going back. Even though, like, he knows it's bad for him, and he knows that he probably should move on, he just loves him too much.
Mm.
And he remembers that sweet boy he used to be, and when he would tell me he loved me and play with my hair. Like, just, yeah. I don't know. It's like, is it? But then there's also, like, a hint that you mentioned, because, like, Viserys refers to Alicent as Emma before he goes to bed.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, maybe is he a bit senile at this point?
Something's going on there. There's been a development.
Yeah, definitely. He clearly doesn't look well. Let's say that. But yeah, we don't know what's going on mentally in that scenario. So I guess there is a case saying, you know, maybe this is just him regressing to a state, like a previous state of what he knew about Daemon. Like treating that as like a comfort blanket.
Yeah. Absolutely. Even when Daemon is saying things like, "Seems the gods have been especially unkind to you," and such.
spoiler alert, I do also get the line of the episode here.
We will save it till later, I think. Yeah.
Okay.
I think most people know.
Oh, I'm what pretty it sure is, people know.
But yeah, we'll speak it aloud when we get to the end of the show.
You're looking to place blame for an act of the gods.
Mayhaps the gods have scorned us for our insatiable pride.
The crown was yours until those fools at the Great Council plucked it from your head. Is it such a terrible thing for your husband to wish to win it back?
Tonight of all nights, let us lay aside this falsehood. It's not justice for your wife that drives you, it is your own ambition. It is desire for the throne. If not for yourself, then for the scions of your house. I gave up the idea of wearing a crown a generation ago. It is you, Lord Husband, who refuses to abandon this pursuit, even now at the cost of our children.
As night falls, Rhaenys and Corlys openly discuss the fact that while Rhaenys accepted that she was never going to become queen, Corlys has relentlessly pursued the Iron Throne ever since. Daemon and Rhaenyra walk along the beach together and, after a brief conversation, become intimate with one another. While this is happening, Aemond walks out of the castle at night and claims Vhagar, Laena's former dragon. The sound of Vhagar flying overhead wakes up Rhaenyra and Daemon, while Baela, Rhaena, Luke and Jace are also woken up when they realise that Vhagar has been stolen. So, we'll talk about Corlys and Rhaenys first, their little conversation. I just want more Eve Best.
I really want more Eve Best
as this goes on. Like, I love her in this role so much. Every time Rhaenys speaks the truth, it's just like there's this bitterness to the fact that, like, she knows that she's telling the truth. And I just love how Eve Best has played Rhaenys as this woman who knows the way of the world, but has just kind of has learned to just kind of go, well, you know, fine, you know, she has a great understanding of the world, but she has no energy left to fight against what it's like. And she just wants to raise a family and, like, be who she is and, like, keep their position. But also, I think that Corlys is also right in this conversation. And I like that he shows loyalty to Jace and Luke, where he says, you know, history doesn't remember blood, it remembers names. And they, like, they have our names and we need to stand up for them. And it's a really good conversation where they're both right. And you understand why both of them are talking the way that they are.
Yeah, you've summed it up perfectly. What I had, like, they are just both right in this scenario. But you feel terrible for Rhaenys in particular, because I think you do just get the sense that all she kind of wants is a quiet life at this point. She doesn't want to have to spend the rest of her life thinking, you know, what if, what if, what if. It's like, what good does that do? Because I think she's at the point where she's admitted that it's never going to happen anyway, so why even try? You may as well just... I think she's more focused on trying to secure a better future for her family, like you say, which I think is... You know, it's entirely reasonable. But also, like you say, Corlys is completely right that she did get screwed out of the throne. And, you know, it's a shame, but I think kind of going around in circles like this until the day you die just does nobody any favours.
No, absolutely not. So this scene on the old beach, we kind of talked about it at the beginning. But I guess we can mention the lighting and go into depth with it now.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have any way to sort of expand on what you said before, or if you want to.
I haven't got much, really. I think I've already kind of pointed it out that, like, you know, people like Emma Darcy and Matt Smith, like, we've seen evidence in this episode that they're so good at telling stories via their, you know, their facial expressions and their body language. And it's like, if you can't see that, then that does them a disservice. Like, what good are subtle glances if you can't actually see them?
It's so strange because they're just... I feel like I saw them. I don't know what... If my TV's brightness settings are, like, off different to somebody else's. I'm really not sure, but like, I think what kind of bothered me was that I was very distracted by the fact that I knew that it was daytime and that they put it on. Yes. I think that was what distracted me. It didn't really stop me seeing anything, but it did leave me feeling a little bit confused as to whether it was kind of just after sunset or just before sunrise. I couldn't tell when it was supposed to be, whether like they'd all gone to bed and then they'd got up at like 4 in the morning or 3 in the morning and it was sunny off somewhere, but like, you know, it was going to be sunny, like it was summer and the sun just hadn't come up yet, or if it was like just beyond twilight. Like it kind of reminded me of like being a kid and like playing football out in the street, and then it gets to like 10 o'clock at night on the school holidays and you're allowed to stay out, but like you have to stop playing football because you just can't see the ball anymore, and it's dangerous when it's moving at those speeds, and like you're just kind of going anyway because it's too cold. Like that's kind of what the lighting reminded me of. But it also reminded me of like when I've been camping or something like that, and you will always wake up early on your first night in a tent.
Yeah.
And you get up and the light kind of hangs in that funny halfway point between nighttime and like sunrise, and I couldn't quite, it lost me for a second in terms of like the time that it was occurring. But the actual scene itself, it's a really nice parallel with the scene between Rhaenyra and Laenor in one of the earlier episodes, because Rhaenyra walks on a beach with the person that she's just about to get married to, it seems.
Yeah.
So I don't know why that is, but I do think that this scene fills a gap that's been there in the story, and I like the fact that they've left it until now, which is just that they've both felt, Rhaenyra and Daemon, they've both felt incomplete up to now. And I think...
That's true.
You know, there's always been something that has... You know, they've been left unsatisfied by their lot and what they have. And I've never quite been able to place what it is. And it turns out that it was just sort of each other in that way. Even though it was a very obvious kind of grooming scenario in episode 4... You know, as Rhaenyra's grown up, it's now something else. And I think that the problems that could have been caused by kind of hurrying it together, I think, like what Jay pointed out, I think the fact that there's this missing piece, and then when they finally, you know, start kissing and have sex, and then obviously later in the episode get married, that piece doesn't feel like it's missing anymore. And so I think that they've just created space for something to just get put into it. They've not built up to it that carefully, but they've done enough setup with them away from each other for it to be a sort of like a... There are points of this episode that do feel like a season finale emotionally, where lots of characters admit things to each other and behave in certain ways, that there are points of no return and lots of payoffs that we've seen building up. And I think that the sex scene is one of them. It's just that this is where the lighting started to bother me a little bit, because it's about, you know, sex scenes, and especially the way that Miguel Sapochnik has shot, not necessarily sex scenes in the past for Game of Thrones, but at least romantic and intimate scenes. It's always been about the contrast between the light and the dark, and how bodies create silhouettes. And with those silhouettes, you can communicate a lot of meaning. The one I always think of is in The Bells, when Jon and Daenerys are trying to kind of rekindle their relationship. But halfway through that kiss, Jon realizes that he can't go through with their relationship anymore because he knows that they're related. And as he backs away, you see the fire forming between them. And it's all about like the playfulness between like empty space and colour and light and shade, and it just doesn't come through in this because everything's kind of washed over with that blue, they say that dark blue, and you trying to spot little things on the characters. Like Damon's got this huge scar on his shoulder from when he was, I think it's from when he was hit by an arrow in an earlier episode, like a flaming arrow, and so like he's burnt from like his right shoulder up to his neck and sort of partway down his arm, and I'm trying to pierce through this like blue filter and like squint my eyes just to kind of make it out. And I don't know if I should really be doing that, because
yeah,
it's hard to play incestual sex scenes, because it's hard to play them too romantically and code them as like a soft intimate thing, but also we have to understand the character's points of view in this situation, so you can't just frame it as an entirely negative incident that's happening here. And it's difficult to play that balance, and I think it's harder to play that balance when you're struggling to see the difference between certain skin tones and like clothes and like, you know, skin against sand and little things like that. It's a nice scene, and I think it feels like a relatively organic progression, but I do think that it's just a little mark against the episode that the finer details of it, I just couldn't quite see them, and it made it harder for the scene to communicate what it was going for.
Yeah, I agree.
Moving on to the scene that Cornwall's Tourist Association will be very happy with, which is, well, they will be happy with the whole episode, I imagine, but Aemond claiming Vhagar, how are we on that?
Yeah, because it's kind of an improvement for him at least. Because in the previous episode, he seemed like a bit of he's kind of the black sheep, and he seemed a bit timid almost. So for him to just square up to Vhagar like that is, you know, quite something. But also, I didn't really get much from the actual flying scene itself. I'm sure it took a lot of effort to put that together, but it kind of it came off a bit like Harry Potter to me.
People comparing it to Harry and Buckbeak.
Yeah.
In Prisoner of Azkaban.
Yeah, it's like, it's obviously not the meat of the episode for me. Like, everything after this is what hooked me in.
Yeah, I think the flying scene is really nice. I think that Aemond claiming Vhagar is, obviously, it's a massive turning point for the story. Because now the Greens have the biggest dragon. It also means, it also shows that Aemond has kind of grown sick of the upbringing that he's had and the way that the other kids look down on him. And so he's kind of just gone full on, you know, he's kind of like, you know, Dutch courage, but without all the alcohol. It's just, you know, he's just sort of blindly gone into this and has just sort of managed to do it. And even when he's swinging from the saddle, like, oh, Jesus Christ, what have I got myself into? Once he brings Vhagar back under control, that's really quite a moment, I think, for the story going forward. I think it's one of those that, like, new viewers who've, like, not read the book and stuff, it'll be a moment that they look back on, I think, and be like, ah, this is where this began, or, you know, that sort of thing, on rewatches, if you will. I think the show has played it really well so far with balancing moments for book readers and balancing moments for show only. I think like they've assumed that more people watching this have read the books than haven't, and I don't think that's necessarily true of the wider audience. So, and I think maybe this might be a moment like this where you're like, oh, cool, he's claimed a dragon, but like, you know, Vhagar is like so old. Like, taking control of Vhagar is, like, a massive deal, because the dragon's so bloody old, and, like, is the only dragon left that was alive when Aegon took the Seven Kingdoms, and, like, you know, she's the biggest in the Seven Kingdoms, she's been missing for a long time, she's kind of become, like, a mythical creature. There was something, though, that was spoken aloud by Ryan Condal after the episode.
Okay.
He talked about how they characterised Vhagar for this scene. And so when I first found out that there were eventually going to be 17 dragons in this show, you know, there's going to be 9 introduced in the first season as a whole, but, like, you know, there's going to be eventually, like, loads of them. And I was thinking, how are they going to characterize them all individually? And I thought, oh, they're just going to give them, like, the characteristics of animals or pets. Because I always thought that Drogon just reminded me of, like, a dog. The way that he was with Daenerys. And I thought, okay, so, you know, now there's more dragons. They'll characterize them like dog or a bearded dragon or, like, a cat or a mouse or a rat or something like that. And... or like with Vhagar, where it's like they've not Vhagar, it's like with Caraxes, where they've modelled him off a worm, and little things like that. And right, and then what Jay said last week about Vhagar being like the world's oldest cat.
Yeah.
And Ryan Condal has described Vhagar as a grumpy old cat after this episode, and it's just amazing. I could not believe it. When he said that, and I was like, oh, I need to text Jay, I need to tell him. I really could not believe that he just said that out loud. That was pretty funny.
Yeah, it's perfect.
The way that we're looking at the dragons is how the show intended them to be looked at.
Yeah.
Little thing I noticed as well is that the Daenerys theme came on during this scene. When Vhagar got up to fly, they did the string where it kind of goes like blah, 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 like that in the soundtrack whenever Daenerys is like ready to go Dracarys or whatever like that, and she goes Dracarys, and then like there's a bit of a pregnant pause, and then the music goes blah, 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 and then it drops into like a heavier score, and it did exactly the same thing here, and I was quietly pleased about that.
Yeah.
Alistair, stay with the king.
Hold your ground.
Stay your hand, Paul.
You've gone too far.
What have I done? But what was expected of me? Forever upholding the kingdom, the family, the law. Will you flout it all to do as you please?
Alicent, let her go.
Where is duty? Where is sacrifice? It's trampled under your pretty foot again.
Release the blade, Alicent.
And now you take my son's fight. And to even that you feel entitled.
Exhausting, wasn't it? Hiding beneath the cloak of your own righteousness. But now they see you as you are.
In the morning, but not quite, after Aemon lands from his ride on Vhagar, he is confronted by Daemon and Rhaenyra's children. A fight breaks out, during which Aemon refers to Jace and Luke as bastards, and in retaliation, Luke slices Aemon's eye with a blade, and it is revealed afterwards that Aemon will lose the eye for good. During a tense meeting of all the families in the Great Hall at Driftmark, Alicent demands that Luke also lose an eye as equal retribution for her son's injury. This is a request that Viserys denies. Alicent decides to take matters into her own hands as a result and tries to attack Luke herself with the Valyrian steel dagger, only for Rhaenyra to stand in her way. As the incident begins to calm down, Alicent slices at Rhaenyra with the dagger and leaves a large cut on her forearm. Afterwards, Otto visits Alicent in her chambers and tells her that with patience, the Hightower family will prevail. So, it's all getting a bit knifey up in here. What do we make of the kids' fighting scene?
Yeah, probably the highlight of the episode. Well, but I mean, I guess this overall section is the highlight of the episode, but... like, the, you know, even just the initial fight and the aftermath is, well, it's obviously much more gruesome here, but I did sense a strong nod to The King's Road in this sequence with how it uses its younger characters to further a feud between families, or a family in this case, as it's technically a feud within the same family. It's like, much like Joffrey in The King's Road, you get the sense that Aemon in particular bears the emotional scars of having a parent live vicariously through their child, but that's not really an excuse for his actions, which he typically denies and twists in order to accuse the other side of wrongdoing.
Yeah, do you know, when you first messaged me about that, about this being this episode containing a nod to The King's Road, I was a little bit like, what do you mean? And then just watching it again, in my head, when I was watching this scene, and then the next scene where King Viserys is like, okay, explain the truth of this. All I was thinking of was Joffrey, Arya, Sansa with Nymeria in the King's Road, and then like Robert Baratheon going, "Look, children, fight. It's over." You know, like that kind of thing, and then Cersei going, "No, we must." We must get retribution. We must, you know, Joffrey will bear these scars for life and all of this. And then it ends up with Lady being killed. And yeah, it's basically the same. Where
it is.
Kids basically pushed into conflict by their parents fight. And then the fight worsens the conflict between the parents. It's great. But yeah. This is one of my favourite scenes to read in the book, and I think that the adaptation of it that they've done is really good. I think I can't 100% remember where the scene happens in the book. I have a feeling it may take place in King's Landing, but whatever. It's a great adaptive change. It plays to this episode's strengths, I think, and it basically... It really supports the decision the writers have made to move everything to Driftmark this week and have it away from King's Landing for a bit and just be somewhere else and to have things happen while they're on holiday, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, technically not on holiday, they're at a funeral, but, you know. Like, you know, things happen while they're away so that when they come back to King's Landing, everything's different. And, yeah, it's a really tense and kind of violent scene because I remember watching Blind Wave, the reaction channel, and whenever like kids did anything evil or evil things happened to kids in Game of Thrones, there was one of the panelists always used to sit there and go, "I hate kids in Game of Thrones." And like, it's the same with this, where like, you know, you got four or five kids all fighting with each other and like throwing sand at each other and hitting each other over the head with rocks and punching each other in the face, really, like, you know, really heavily and like causing some damage there, and then eventually a blade comes out and whoops, you know, someone's losing an eye. But the scene in the Great Hall is one I've been curious to see ever since it was in the first trailer for this show. Like a year ago, all of this was in the first teaser trailer, and it was like, what, Alicent with a blade? Like, what's going on? Is that the Valyrian steel dagger from Game of Thrones? What? Like, this didn't happen. And like, it's something else that like they've kind of just added in. They've slightly changed it. Like, there's no real mention of Alicent coming at Rhaenyra over this in the aftermath with a knife or anything like that. It completely shifts like the dynamic of the relationship and stuff like that. And we saw this scene in the trailer, like, how is this going to pan out? Like, how does this happen? Where does this develop? And yeah, it's fantastic. And it really, really pays off, again, the decision to have them be the same age, because they're going through the same things at the same time. All their children are the same age. And it just, I don't know, it creates this unbearable tension. And then this is the moment of no return, where Alicent just comes at Rhaenyra with a fucking dagger. Brilliant stuff from Olivia Cooke and Darcy. They both just really steal the scene from everybody else. I don't know how you feel about the stuff in front of the fireplace.
Yeah, it's like, even last week there was a hint that maybe, you know, they could eventually, like, not be friends again, but they could put their differences aside. But no, this week, like, the battle lines are drawn. Like, there's no way back. They are enemies at this point. Also, even just before that, you know, with the kids squabbling, I like some of the shots of the observers, like Otto seeming content to just let the chaos play out, and as I mentioned to you, Daemon doing his best Littlefinger impression by leaning on the wall with a smug look on his face.
Well, I've got nothing to do with this.
Yeah.
For once, I can't get in trouble. Yes, that's it. I can sit back and watch the chaos and no one will turn to me and go, what were you doing in this? So, he manages
but also,
to get away with it.
Yeah, he does the noble thing and steps in front of Kristen Cole and says, like, well, what are you going to do, stab me? You're going to make this even more of a bloodbath?
Yeah, I think at this point, the Greens have... they've just grown impatient, I think. You know, like, I think being referred to by, you know, your husband's dead wife's name is probably, like, one of the final insults you get before you just snap. And so this is the point where they've snapped. I think a lot of... I just want to say as well, like, I've noticed online this week, like, the massive group of, like, Targaryen stans who are, like, coming for Alicent, like, and the way that they... picking side between the Greens and, as Rhaenyra's group will eventually be called, the Blacks. Like, picking side between the Greens and the Blacks, like, and really going to town on it. Like, have you seen, Alicent has a nickname, a really cruel nickname in, like, online circles at the moment? I don't know if you've picked up on this. So if you replace the E in her name with a U, that's what they're calling her. And it's like, they're not real people. Like, they're characters in a world that doesn't exist. I can't believe we're going through all of this again.
That just gives me a hint of, like, oh, it's Libor with Tony B. Liar. Like, get it? You know, it's not clever. Just,
yeah.
I don't know. Like, don't do that.
This tweet that went round: Viserys is so weak, he should have had Alicent's head right there and then for treason. And fine, whatever.
But
and then
not a good way to tell a story.
And
you know.
I've been saying this ever since. Someone saying she served her purpose, he has heirs, Sis can go. Should have had Cole's head and given them all a message. And it's just like, and I saw one as well.
Yeah.
It was like, there's a picture of the Greens from next week. All of them decked out in green, like, you know, various hairs and stuff like that. Various wigs and blonde hair and things like that. And there's people who seem to, I don't know if they're joking or not, but they seem to be genuinely angry that, like, the High Towers have, like, dirtied the Targaryen blood. And it's like them. It's like these people have just completely gone past the irony of the fact that they're called Targaryens. Like, this not a thing? And it just, is this not the irony that, like, you know, they're like these beautiful white blonde people, and like you're talking about messing up bloodlines, like, you know, just it's a TV show. Like, take it seriously and love it.
Yeah,
and enjoy
analyze
it,
but you know,
remain at a distance and remember that these people are not real, and like your characters and enjoy watching them and stuff. But I think of all the shows in like this is not like it's not a show that tells you like, oh, you must like this side and hate this side. Like, the whole thing about, you know, the source material that they're adapting is that, and it was the same with Game of Thrones, it's just, they're just people trying to do things. They're caught up in this illusion of a Game of Thrones. They're making a lot of decisions based on that.
Yep.
You know, we're seeing how the adults in the room have been raised to behave the way that they do, because the adults in the room are currently raising their children to raise in the same way, to behave in the same way.
Yep.
And I don't know. I just, maybe calm down a bit. Like, just, you don't, whenever Alicent's on screen, you don't have to, like, dig your nails into your palms and, like, grit your teeth and call her horrible names online. Because this always ends up with the actors getting abuse for playing characters. And it's just a job. Like,
yeah,
they don't...
Yeah.
It was something that John Bradley said a few weeks ago on this podcast that he did with Scroobius Pitt, where he was like, the thing that quite a lot of fans forget is that the actors and the people involved don't actually care anywhere near as much as we do. Like, it's just a job. Like, it's, you know, like, the people writing this show are not doing these things just to make Alicent look worse or to totally justify whatever Rhaenyra does or is going to do. Like, they're just people in a potboiler, and, like, we're just watching them do things. Like, it's just a Petri dish. Like, get excited about it and love it and analyse it, pick it apart, that's great. But just try to maintain some distance and remember that they don't exist. As George R. R. Martin said, you know, we're just making this shit up. You know?
I don't even feel angry towards Alison in this scene. I feel really sorry for her. She just looks like you say, she just looks like she's at the end of a tether with everything happening with, you know, Viserys clinging on, but basically being a walking corpse, and Otto in her ear, like, this, like, telling her to play the game, and, you know, her kids running around being all fucked up, and one of them essentially being an alcoholic, and he's not even 16. And, like, yeah, you would snap, and, like, you would take it out on someone who doesn't necessarily deserve it. It's not really an excuse for that behaviour, but yeah.
Just to expand on what you were saying there, like, there is a difference between a reason and an excuse for behaviour. And yeah. Alison does not really behave reasonably in this scene, but she's been driven to quite unreasonable behaviour by quite strange and baffling circumstances where everybody in the kingdom is just kind of ignoring the fact that, like, the direct, you know, the direct challenge to her son's ascension to the throne is, like, very obviously not legitimate. And, like, under their, you know, like, under their law, obviously none of us really in the modern world really care about Luke and Jace's actual parentage or anything like that, but
no.
Just mad that, like, you know, she's looking at these kids like, how can you not see that they're not legitimate? Why is everybody playing this stupid game?
She's like just Frank Grimes.
Rotting away. It's just, yeah. But yeah, I don't agree with anything that Alison does in this episode, but, like, it's not really about agreement with this show. It's about understanding. It's like with Daenerys at the end of Game of Thrones, it's like, of course I don't agree with everything that she does, but, like, you understand why she's been driven to that point, and that's the whole thing with Game of Thrones. It's not about, and House of the Dragon, it seems as well, is it's not about supporting one team or another. And I will quote Shireen Baratheon, who read about this story many, many, many years from now, and when Stannis asked her, who would you have chosen, the Greens or the Blacks, she said nobody, because it was the choosing that made everything so horrible. And that's the lesson
yes.
for today.
Yes.
We made an arrangement all those years ago to do our duty and yet explore happiness. But there are times, I think, when these things cannot mutually exist. Sir Carl will return soon to the fighting in the Stepstones. But I recommit myself to you and to strengthening our house as we prepare you for your ascension. I will raise our sons to be princes of the realm.
Lynn.
You deserve better than what I have been. You deserve a husband.
The next morning, as Rhaenyra's wound is stitched up, Laenor comes to visit her, promising to be a better husband. After the Hightowers leave Driftmark and return to King's Landing with Viserys, Rhaenyra and Daemon promise to unite against the Greens, knowing that a battle for the Iron Throne is imminent. Rhaenyra asks Daemon to marry her. Daemon agrees, but remarks that Laenor must die for their marriage to stand a chance of being recognised. Daemon then visits Carl in a secret location and pays him to give Laenor a quick death with many witnesses. Later, Daemon breaks into Driftmark and kills a guard, presumably stashing his body away, and soon after, Carl and Laenor engage in a fight by a fireplace. By the time Corlys and Rhaenys arrive, Carl has fled the scene and a charred body is found in the fireplace. Rhaenyra and Daemon are married some time later, and it is then revealed that Laenor and Carl and Rhaenyra and Daemon were all in a scheme together, that Laenor and Carl are both still alive, having changed their identities and fled Westeros. This is probably my favourite point of the show so far. This is a great decision, and it plays out very well. It's a big change from the books, and I love it. I love it. It's the first time that, like, the show has made a change, and I haven't just sat there and gone, yes, I like that. You know, I was actually sat there open-mouthed And that's a hell of an achievement, considering I've read the book and know exactly what's going to happen in terms of the larger plot points. And they've had me sat there like, So how do you feel about this whole scheme and the wedding and the montage and everything like that?
Well, I was going to open it up to you because it seems like you have, you took a lot away from this, particularly as a book reader. Like, for me, I definitely liked it. I was maybe a little bit confused about the time scale because we go from the sword fight between Leia and Carl, and then the boy sort of runs out, and then the guy, everyone else comes in, like Corlys and Rhaenys and whatnot, a little bit later. But the way we see it is that it's like one follows the other immediately, and then there's just the burning body.
Mm.
And so I was a little bit confused. It's like, well, how did they slip out so easily? And who is the body?
I guess the body is the guard that Dane kills.
Of course.
And so they char him beyond recognition, they've killed this guy in order to have a character we know get away. But it's a great decision. And I've written about this for the Metro, as I said at the top. I don't just want to crib lines from it, so I won't have it up in front of me. I'll try to just do it organically as if that piece had never been written. First of all, Rhaenyra's going to have a permanent scar that will always remind her of how her friendship with Alicent turned sour and went to shit. Great joke as well. Whoever said this show didn't have humour, I should have been there. Those should be our house words. Great line from Rhaenyra. Fire is a prison. The sea offers an escape. It's great. It's just really, really poetic. And it sets up everything that happens afterwards. Initially in the montage, they do make you think that Rhaenyra and Daemon are actually going to scheme to kill Laenor. Because they start using language like, you know, if Rhaenyra says the sea is an escape, and then Daemon's like, set him free and like do this, and like, you know, because there's a little thing earlier in the episode I think about, like, you know, this sense that in the burial tradition it's like, you know, Laenor has been set free upon the waves, and like you were saying, you saw the contrast about the two children leaving out to sea in different ways, and so you get Daemon wearing his crime hoodie again when he's speaking to Carl, talking about bribing him, and you think like, oh, and like as a book reader, I'm kind of sat there thinking, oh, this is how it happens. This feels a bit weird. This doesn't quite work for me. Cause like Carl and, you know, cause the way that it happens in the books is like, apparently, Carl and Laenor go traveling. Laenor takes on a new lover. Carl becomes jealous. There's an argument. Carl kills him. Corlys goes to collect Laenor's body. That's kind of the end of the matter.
Okay.
It just kind of ends. And that means that Rhaenyra and Daemon can marry each other. So I thought, is this how they're going to do it? It's like Daemon agreed to like get Laenor assassinated, which is a little theory that came out of the books where it was like Mushroom posits that like it was Daemon that paid Carl to do it. And so they kind of use both versions of the story in the book, and then they exploit a little gap that's in there, which is that obviously we're reading a book, we weren't there, we didn't see what actually happened. Maybe Laenor did go away and it was someone else's body, but like, the book never really questions it, though. The book just kind of, oh yeah, Laenor died. Like, that's all it really kind of leaves you feeling. And so the show, to completely flip that on its head and have its own twist independently of the books and try to be its own show and go on its own two legs a little bit, you know, it's all of the, so many of the adaptive changes it's made so far have had me sat there going like, yes, what a good idea. I can see how that works, etc., etc. Whereas, like I said, with this, I was heartbroken for Rhaenys and Corlys, especially Rhaenys. Like, her face, like, hot with tears and grief. you know, just put one child to rest and now here's another.
Yep.
And so I was sat there like, you know, Jesus Christ, that fucking hell. And then it gets revealed that, like, it was a scheme all along. And so you're like, oh, well, what a relief. Lenore and Carl are still alive and they can go off and be happy somewhere else. And Lenore can have all this pressure taken off him. No one's going to care who he is, what his identity is, what his sexuality is. Him and Carl could just go off and be together. And I thought, oh, well, how lovely, you know. And considering, I think a lot of very premature articles about Bury Your Gays were written about this show.
Yeah.
Which is probably advice that, like, you know, in this kind of, you know, write about everything in the moment and get reviews out immediately kind of online culture that we live in, maybe just best to let things sit for a minute, eh? Anyway, but then finally, you know, as you've probably guessed from this episode, because there's a very telegraphed shot during the dagger scene where the two teams in the room split in half, Corlys and Rhaenys join up with Rhaenyra's claim to the throne. Like, you know, they become part of the Blacks because they want to protect their grandchildren.
Yeah.
And so every time that Rhaenyra, Daemon, Rhaenys and Corlys are going to be on screen together, it's going to be like, the source of your greatest pain was caused by your allies and you have no idea. And so the audience is given this huge, like, skitload of dramatic irony to sit with. Because we know that Lenore is fine, but every time they come on screen now and talk to each other, we're going to be sat there like, ooh, if you knew what she did. And, like, it's just such a great idea. Really, really is a great idea. It's the sign of a show making not just an adaptive change, but, like, really flipping the table with it and playing around with the little purposeful gaps in George R. R. Martin's material and having a lot of fun with it and making a decision all of its own that greatly informs the story that it's going to tell. And well done to them for doing it. And I was sat there about 7:30, 7:45 by this point, just, like, just about to start work. Like, oh, I need to write about this today. Like, you know, just to kind of get it out there and, like, wow, yeah, really, really something. How do you feel about it as someone who just kind of sees it as a TV twist and, like, it's not necessarily from the books? It's, like, it's a, you know, if as far as you're concerned, everything the show is doing is original material and that sort of thing. And so how do you feel about it as, like, just a progression of the story?
Yeah, I really like it, but then it does also raise other questions, which I'm sure will be answered at a later date. But it's like, well, for one, that's a very small boat and a very big sea. Like, is there any chance that we will actually see Lenore again? Because, like you say about, you know, within the Blacks, there is this sense of, you know, they don't know what we actually did. Is that we kind of saved your son's life instead of killing him. But it's like, I guess, is there a chance that it's one of those, it's like, what will happen first? Will someone let slip or will Lenore show up somehow? So.
Yeah, that's curious because that's also what I'm thinking too, because in the books, Lenore, obviously he's died. He never shows up again.
And yeah, so, of course, yeah.
I don't know if this is the end for him in the show or whether he'll come back at some point.
I like that we both don't know the answer to this.
Yeah, exactly. I love that the show has done this because whenever a character doesn't die, there's always a chance that they're going to appear again at some point in the future.
Yeah.
And who knows? Like, you know, I mean, obviously, I'm trying very hard not to spoil, like, major future events, but, like, that piece of information is out there, and rightly so, Lizzie, you're wondering, like, what happens first? Like, does it even get a let slip? Like,
yeah.
If it does get let slip, who does? Is it something to do with Lenore? Maybe, like, I can't stay away any longer, I need to come back, and all this stuff. It's just, yeah, it's just a great ending. And, like, Miguel Sapochnik used montage really well in the first episode of the show. He's used montage really well in this to kind of play with the audience a little bit. We get some really strong imagery from Damon and Rhaenyra's wedding, just with the binding of the blood and, like, the cut in the lips. And I don't quite know where that wedding is. I presume it's Dragonstone, but obviously because we've spent so much time on an island by the sea, like, you know, like they sort of blend into one another. But, I mean, Driftmark and Dragonstone are right next to each other, but, yeah, it's... That's the only mark against that, but it's very, very tiny. But it all comes together and brings this really good episode to a really good close that has made me, like, excited to see if there are any other major adaptive changes going to be made in the future.
I suppose, like, we'll see.
Yeah, because the story kind of expands again in... Because from season one will cover about 30 years by the time it's over, whereas season two will probably cover about 9 months. And there's going to be more characters to introduce, and we're going to go to other places in Westeros and things like that. And I'm curious to see how, like, they roll things together or, like, fold storylines together, if they're kind of similar, or whether certain characters will be composites of other characters. Like how David Benioff and Dan Weiss were keen to, like, condense George R. R. Martin's text at basically any given opportunity, where they saw fit to narrow it down for TV purposes. And I'm just, and I always liked a lot of not all of them, but I liked a lot of the changes that Benioff and Weiss made to suit the show. And it feels like a lot of the changes so far that the writers of House of the Dragon have made have definitely suited the show, but not in a way that's kind of caught me off guard like this. Like, now I know how a lot of book readers felt in the middle of season 4 when Game of Thrones introduced the Night King for the first time, and all the TV viewers went to the book readers like, who's this? And all the book readers looked back and went, we don't know! And so it's like, it feels a little bit like House of the Dragon has finally had its moment, and, like, in that regard, like, its first kind of original moment. And also, I've said before, I think, on the podcast, that I've not been tempted to watch any of the Burlington Bar videos thus far, the reaction videos. But this was the first time I thought, yeah, I'm going to see how people react to this. I'm going to see whether the montage, A, tricks them into thinking that Laenor was actually dead, and then the sudden, woof, no, he's actually alive, and, like, how people actually reacted to that. This feels like the show is building towards the fact that it is going to become more of a Game of Thrones-style efficient moments show, where you're going to want to watch people who are not in the know react to it. Like, it's going to become more like that, and it's slowly feeding the pieces in, I think. I don't know if you have anything more to say about...
I do not, no. I think we've covered it pretty comprehensively.
All right, then. I will take your line of the episode, Lizzie.
My line of the episode is by Damon to Otto. No matter how fat the leech grows, it always wants for another meal.
Yeah. Who is your loser this week?
My loser of the week is Alicent Hightower.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think... you may get a few Alicent stans disagreeing with that, but apparently, according to social media anyway, they are small in number. Because a lot of people seem to hate Alicent. So who's your winner this week?
My winner of the week, it's a bit of a tricky one this week, but I'll go with Laenor Velaryon. Laenor Velaryon, I should say.
Yes. Yeah.
It's one of those things like with Walder and Waldaf Rey. Like...
Yeah, I think that's totally fine, because he gets away, gets to be with his guy. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Aw. Well, we'll be back next week, hopefully all three, full compliment. Get well soon, Jay.
Get well soon.
For season 1, episode 8, The Lord of the Tides, I think it's going to be called. So, still Driftmark-y, Velaryon-y stuff to be dealt with. Ooh. And we will see you for it.
See ya.